Welcome to ForTruth.net, a ministry of the North American Mission Board. I'm Rob Bowman, Manager of Apologetics and Interfaith Evangelism. Our mission is to equip people in our churches to be able to share with others the reasons for the hope that is within them as they seek to reach North America for Jesus Christ. Today I'm speaking with Paul Copan, Pledger Family Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida. He is the author of a series of books responding to common objections to Christianity, including the books True for You but Not for Me, That's Just Your Interpretation, and How Do You Know You're Not Wrong? Dr. Copan, welcome to ForTruth.net.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you, Rob.
Thanks for joining me here. I'd like to talk to you today about relativism. The title of your book, True for You but Not for Me, nicely captures at least the essence of popular relativism. Could you define for us exactly what the word relativism means?
All right. Well, the idea of relativism has to do with something that is true for one person may not necessarily be true for another person. Now, we're not just talking about ice cream flavors here, like I like vanilla, you like chocolate, but someone might believe that God exists, and another person who's a relativist might say, well, you know, that's true for you, but not for me. God exists for you is the idea, but not for me. In other words, we basically come up with our own ideas of what truth is. We come up with our own ideas of reality and so forth, and those things are true for us, but they may not be true for another person. So you can have a belief that, say, adultery is wrong for the Christian, but the relativist might say, well, that's just right for you, but not for me. So you can have relativism that relates to truth and truth claims, as well as to moral claims. That's right for you, but not for me. So basically, truth is relative to a particular person, or you can speak more broadly, to a particular culture, but not necessarily for others. We might do some things in this culture that other people don't do, and so a lot of people get this idea that, well, everything must be relative. It's all a matter of what one culture thinks is true, and that's just true for them, but we have our own truth and so forth.
Now, what would the alternative be to relativism? Is there a term that maybe is used for something that rejects relativism, and what would that be, and how would that look?
Well, the idea of truth as being relative has a sense of what has been called subjectivism, and that typically relates to individuals. You know, this is my truth and so forth. And relativism, more properly speaking, deals with a broader cultural or a larger grouping sort of sense or view of truth. But the opposite, or the alternative, is that of objectivity, or objectivism, some people phrase it. And that is the idea that something is true whether people believe it or not. That it is a belief or a story or an idea matches up with the way things really are. So when I say the earth is round, that's because the earth really is round. My truth claim matches up with the way things are in reality. Now, it wouldn't do to say, well, the earth is round for you, but not for me, a flat earther. It's flat for me. That's not the case. Something is, the earth is round whether people believe it or not. So it's objectively true. In other words, it's not dependent upon human mind. For its truth value, but rather it's something that's true in and of itself, even if no one believes it, in fact. So something can be the case, say, out in the universe, we haven't discovered it yet, but something may be true, even though human minds have not yet discovered it. And so that's the idea of the objectivity of truth. It's true independent of human minds.
Okay, now some people who are listening may have this question, and so I'm going to ask it for them. What's the difference between, and some people may not even be aware of the fact that there is a difference between relativism, which you've described as this belief that what may be true for one person might not be true for another person. So what's the difference between relativism and relativity, this idea that comes out of modern science that we often associate with Einstein. What's the difference between relativism and relativity? And does relativity in some way support or prove relativism?
Well, that's a very good question. In fact, back in the 1920s, after Einstein's theories of relativity were being discussed, many people concluded that because there is no privileged vantage point or no privileged point of an observer in the universe, because you know everything is in motion. I mean, you're sitting in a train, a train next to you is moving, and unless you have a third reference point, another fixed point, so to speak, you can't tell who is sitting, who is standing still, and who is moving, or which train is moving, yours or the one next to you. And so the idea that Einstein was talking about was back even in the 1920s, being confused with relativism. And what we want to do is make sure that some things are clear here. We're not talking about relativity theory. Now, there is certainly something to relativity theory, that there is some contingency, that there is some, there are certain perspectival issues that one person might have a certain perspective, might see things as traveling at a certain speed, whereas a person who is maybe traveling closer to the speed of light might see things differently, and it might not be going at the same speed, clocks slowing down or speeding up depending upon your the speed of light and so forth at which you're traveling. And so the whole issue of relativity, even with relativity, we need to understand that light still travels at a certain fixed rate. It's not as though my understanding or my version of light traveling at one speed is different from your version of light's travel at a different speed. No, it's fixed and constant, and so there are a number of things that are still constant despite the fact that things may vary depending upon where we are in relationship to other objects in space. So I don't know if you want me to go into more detail, but that's probably good enough, I think.
Well, I think so, and I think it's very important for people to understand this point that you made, that in Einstein's theory of relativity, light travels at the same velocity for all observers. It is an absolute fixed datum or truth of the physical world, according to Einstein, irrespective of one's vantage point. Other things may vary, but that doesn't. So that is the evidence that relativity, in some sense, presupposes and confirms that there are absolute truths, there are objective realities that are true for all observers. And so, ironically, it's been turned into something that it is very much not, which is some kind of argument for relativism.
Right.
And I think people do confuse those two terms.
Yeah, and even if people could somehow conclude that things are relative, at least based on relativity, you could at least say that, well, the theory of relativity is at least true for everyone. So it pertains to everyone. It's not as though the theory of relativity would be just true for one person but not for another. No, this is something that itself would be universally true, objectively true, independent of people's vantage point and so forth.
Correct. Now, there's a confusion, I think, in a lot of people's minds among a variety of ideas that we should disentangle because, again, I think there's just a lot of confusion. One is, I think people are confused between the claim of relativism that what's true for you may not be true for me. They may confuse that with what we might describe as humility in knowledge claims. In other words, the stance of saying, I'm not going to assert that everything I believe is necessarily going to turn out to be right. I may be wrong about some things. I'm fallible. I don't know everything. You don't know everything. This kind of humility or acknowledgement of one's own fallibility, I think, often gets confused with relativism.
That's right. I think that there certainly is a balance. The Apostle Paul in Ephesians 4 talks about speaking the truth in love, and sometimes we don't say certain things because they might be destructive to another person. We are to engage in saying things that, even if they're maybe at the time hurtful, the goal is to build people up and so forth. So there certainly is a balance with when it comes to the whole issue of truth and humility. I think we need to distinguish between truth and the attitude one holds. And I think a lot of times people who are, a lot of times those who call themselves Christians may have this demeanor where there is a certain attitude that goes with assertions or claims about the truth. And what ends up happening is that people who are listening confuse claims of truth with a certain arrogance or a superiority complex that others have. And so there's that danger, on the one hand, to confuse attitudes and truth claims. But on the other hand, you can say, well, 2 + 2 = 4. You can say that just plainly and matter-of-factly, or you can have this attitude that I'm better than you, that I know this and you might not, and so forth. Of course, when we get to issues of religion and so forth, that we're going into deeper, more personal areas. But even when it comes to the sorts of claims that Jesus made, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and so forth, his unique identity claims, it's interesting that he makes certain claims about himself, say, in Matthew chapter 11, where he is the one who both reveals the Father, he reveals the truth of God to human beings, and that he sees himself as uniquely placed to do that. But yet, a few verses later, he talks about being one who is humble of heart, and he invites people to come to this humble person so that they might find rest for their souls. So again, humility and truth claims can go together. And then we can go perhaps to the other point where some people are so reluctant to assert truth claims, to be people of moral conviction, that they end up being timid, they end up being reluctant to speak out about what is true. And perhaps there's that desire to avoid, quote, offending people. But I think we need to keep in mind on that score that there are people who often need to hear certain things told to them, even if it may be hurtful, they may not like it. It might actually be something revolutionary for them, might be something that actually benefits them, that helps them if they are willing to receive it.
Well, and I think that you've touched on another confusion in many people's minds, and that is confusing a stance of relativism with a stance of tolerance or toleration. Could you address that? Again, many people seem to think that in order to be tolerant, you must embrace a relativistic view of truth.
Excellent question. And yet the issue of tolerance certainly does is often used. In fact, the idea of tolerance is seen as the cardinal virtue amongst relativists, that this is the one thing that you ought to do. You ought to be tolerant. So I suppose if we can talk about one moral value that relativists hold above all and expect people to hold to, it is that idea of tolerance. Unfortunately, when you ask people in today's society what they mean by tolerance, what often comes across is this idea of accepting all views as true. That this is a view that is, that you ought to accept all views as true or legitimate, and if you don't, then you're intolerant, you're arrogant and imperialistic and so forth. Now, the problem with that sort of a viewpoint is that if you embrace this idea of truth as accepting, or tolerance as accepting all views as true, what you end up doing is you end up basically sawing off the limb that you're sitting on, because you are engaging in a viewpoint that ends up being incoherent. You're basically saying you ought to be tolerant of all, or accepting of all viewpoints, but I'm not going to accept your viewpoint as true. There are people who say you ought to accept all views as true. And when they do that sort of thing, they will not accept, say, the Christian's view as true, that Jesus is the only way and that there are no other ways to the Father. They will not accept the viewpoint that those who believe that one perspective is correct and others where they disagree would be incorrect. They're not going to accept that view as true. So in that way, they are sawing off the limb that they're sitting on. They hold up a standard of accepting all views as true, but when you disagree with them, then they are no longer holding that view. So the question then becomes, you know, if you say or define tolerance as being accepting all views as true, then why don't you accept my view, which disagrees with your viewpoint, as true? So it's the problem of having a faulty definition of tolerance from the very start.
That's right. I think what people will end up having to say, you know, when confronted with that internal contradiction, is that we should be accepting of all views that are accepting of all views, or
exactly.
Some such thing.
That's right. And what the problem is that people have veered off from the historical understanding of what tolerance is all about, namely. Tolerance has something negative built into it. Tolerance is a negative concept. When we tolerate something, we don't accept it as good or true or legitimate. What we are doing when we're being tolerant is we're putting up with what we don't like. We're putting up with things that we disagree with. We're putting up with error. So, for example, I don't tolerate chocolate. I enjoy chocolate. I celebrate chocolate. But I tolerate things like Brussels sprouts. I mean, I can eat them when I'm over at somebody's house. I'll eat them. I'll be polite. But these are not my favorite things to eat. In fact, they're pretty far down on the list. But I can eat them. I'll show politeness to my host when I'm eating Brussels sprouts that have been served to me. But not my favorite thing. I put up with them. And so tolerance has to do with putting up with something. And what's interesting is that tolerance actually brings together issues such as truth and attitudes towards the truth and respect for people with whom we disagree. So because people are made in the image of God, we can still treat them with respect and kindness even if we disagree with their views. The problem with the relativist is that he collapses these two ideas, and what he confuses rejecting an idea with the rejection of a person. And the Christian will say, no, that is a confusion. In fact, that leads to unnecessary hurt, unnecessarily cutting off conversations. Well, if you don't agree with my view, then that must mean you don't like me. No, not at all. Let's talk about why we disagree. Let's talk about the basis for the viewpoints that we hold, rather than being offended because I say, well, I disagree with that. Well, so we need to distinguish between, again, truth and the attitude a person holds, and also giving people the right to disagree, recognizing that people, we need to explore further. What is the basis for our disagreement? Why do you hold the views that you do? And it can often lead to a very constructive end.
Well, I think you touched on a very important point an important question that needs to be asked in our society today is, on what basis are we going to have tolerance of one another? If the basis is going to be a bald assertion that we ought to be tolerant, the obvious question is, why? Why should, I mean, there are people in our society who are very, very much intolerant. Why should they be tolerant? What's the reason that we're going to give? I think if you have this kind of pure relativistic mindset that all positions are true, well, the intolerant person is just doing what's consistent with their own beliefs, and you really have no basis for objecting to that. But if you start from a Christian point of view, or even simply a point of view that, theistic point of view, that there is a God who created the world, who created human beings, endowed them with certain abilities and certain privileges and certain responsibilities, and that we are supposed to respect one another because There is a God who made all of us, as you said, in his image, with a capacity to have a relationship with God and with each other. And true tolerance flows from that mutual respect of other human beings as valuable in the sight of God and in our own sight, regardless of what they believe, regardless of their belief systems. We're going to regard them as people that God made, and we're going to show some respect for them and some tolerance of their divergent beliefs. Also, if you have a Christian point of view, your goal is not to hurt or suppress or oppress people that don't believe in Christ, but your goal is to win them to faith in Jesus Christ through showing them the love of Christ. Well, you can't do that without tolerating them.
Absolutely right.
So, in fact, evangelism, many people think, is incompatible with tolerance, but it is a great motivation to tolerance, because if you want to evangelize people, of course, then you're going to want to be around them. You're going to want to spend time with them. You're going to want to talk with them without them being afraid of you, and that means tolerating the fact that they don't agree with you. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to speak up and let them know where you disagree, but you're going to have hopefully an engaging, interesting, meaningful discussion about where you differ as well as where you agree, in the hopes of truth coming to light. And I think that really a Christian has the most solid foundation for an attitude of tolerance toward other people that really could be had.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and I think it's, as we're talking to people about our faith, we're not speaking as though we are better than others, because we as Christians are those who recognize that we are the recipients of the grace of God. We are, as one person put it, we are one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. There's no room for a sense of superiority. I'm a Christian and you're not. And giving this idea that we're better than others because we're Christians and they're not. No, we've received from the grace of God, and so what we're doing is we're just passing on some good news. I'd like to use the example of my wife's and my favorite restaurant, the Macaroni Grill. We like to go to this restaurant, and you know, we were very grateful when people told us about it, and we like to tell other people about it because it's a great place to go, not because we feel like we are better than others because we're going there and they are not, but rather we're just happy to share the good news with other people because we're grateful that somebody passed on this bit of good news to us, and it's that way with the gospel. We should not be those who are acting as though we're better. You know, and when we're talking about truth, it's not as though we are coming with a disposition of arrogance, but rather recognizing, you know, I've tasted and seen that the Lord is good, and I just want you to have this experience as well.
Of course, there is a difference, and that is that when you are recommending your favorite restaurant, you're not saying you should not be going to other restaurants for your meals. Only this restaurant is the true restaurant where you will be properly fed, whereas honestly, as evangelical Christians, we are telling non-Christians that Jesus Christ is the only way of salvation. But as you said, we can say that not with an air of superiority or arrogance, but simply letting people know this is the only source of an eternal relationship with the living God.
Sure, exactly, and that's all that I was driving at, the analogy of speaking out of from a viewpoint of, now, I've found some good news, and I want to pass it on to you rather than having this sense of high-mindedness.
That's right. Well, let me ask you, go back to a question I raised earlier and kind of explore it with you a little bit more. Evangelicals have a reputation, as you have acknowledged, I think, already, for coming across in an arrogant way, being very dogmatic. And sometimes I think evangelicals bring this on themselves by the way that they behave and the way they talk, even to one another. I mean, we have evangelicals of various denominations or theological traditions who will speak in the harshest, most demeaning ways about other versions of evangelical Christianity, let alone non-evangelical forms. It seems like we're always fighting about something. And I wonder if you would agree and if you would address this issue of perhaps beyond simply presenting good arguments against relativism, for evangelicals to persuade people to abandon relativism, we also need to model in the way that we talk to one another and the way that we behave toward one another a recognition that having absolute truth and an objective reality out there that God has revealed to us in Scripture does not mean being arrogant, narrow-minded, bigoted, and so forth.
Right. Yeah, it really is a grievous thing to see Christians very divided about issues that tend to be secondary or tertiary and so forth. It seems that they are preoccupied with winning doctrinal debates rather than seeking to communicate with one another out of love and mutual respect for one another. And it is a shame because, as John 13:33 reminds us, Jesus speaking to his disciples says, "By this all will know that you're my disciples if you love one another." We're not to be known for our greater debating skills necessarily. We're not to be known for how well we construct church buildings. We're to be known as people who love. And so that needs to spill over into love for the world for whom Christ has died. And so we are again working at cross purposes with God when we are operating out of this idea that we're just going out there to win battles and so forth rather than to seek to win people to Christ. And I think that when we are seeking to communicate the gospel to others, and I think apologetics is a very important tool when we're communicating our faith to others, but I've known many Christians who like to get into apologetics just to beat up on people and thinking they're doing it for a good cause and so forth. But the goal of bringing apologetics into evangelism is not to beat people up, to win debates and so forth, but rather to help clear away some of the misconceptions and the caricatures and the false understandings of the Christian faith and so forth, to help them to better see who Christ is, that we might worship Christ together. And so that is, I think, often lost as we are engaging in apologetics or evangelism, that we are not out there to win arguments, but really to bring people to worship the Christ whom we worship.
Paul, I think behind a lot of this talk of relativism today is really something a little bit different, though closely related, and that is the idea of skepticism. And I'd like you to address this point that a lot of people, when they say what's true for you is not true for me, they're really thinking one of two things, I think. One is they're thinking that really nothing that we say about God or eternal realities or spiritual things is objectively true. There is no objective truth about these things. But in fact, all we really have are our own subjective opinions. If there is a God, nobody can really know anything about him. All of our beliefs are really mythological constructs, stories that we tell about God to give us meaning and purpose in life, and none of them is objectively true. And the second thing I think a lot of people are thinking when they say what's true for you is not true for me is they're really thinking of truth in a pragmatic sense. That is, they're thinking of truth as whatever works, that's what truth means. And so when they say what's true for you is not true for me, what they're really saying is your beliefs work for you. They give you purpose and meaning in life. They give you a sense of significance. They give you a moral foundation that's helpful to you. I respect that. It's fine that you believe that. I'm glad you believe something that gives you a reason to get up in the morning and a reason to be nice to your neighbor, but it doesn't work for me. I can't use that particular belief system as my foundation for life. So when they say that, they're not really saying it's true as in the classical sense of a corresponding to reality. They're saying it works for you, but it doesn't work for me. So the two things, one is the skepticism that I think underlies so much of modern relativism, and then also the pragmatism that underlies a lot of it.
Okay. Well, I think in the first place, when people are talking in this skeptical sort of way, saying, well, we can't know what about these spiritual realities, we can't know about even if this objective reality exists, we just can't know it. Well, of course, when people are saying those sorts of things, one wonders, where did they get that insight from? You know, where did they find out that we can't have access to that reality? It seems like they at least have access to reality enough to know that you can't have access to it. And so, again, it leads to these problems of incoherence. Why should we even take their viewpoint seriously when they're speaking in this incoherent manner, saying we can't know about this ultimate reality? Basically, this person is saying, you can't know about it. I have this inside scoop that you can't know about it, and just take my word for it that you out there, you unenlightened people, can't know about this, and so just believe me. And then there's also the whole issue of, I think a faulty idea that the philosopher René Descartes passed on to Western civilization, namely that there are that if something is can be qualified as a knowledge claim, if something can be truly described as knowledge, then you have to know it with 100% certainty. It has to be something that you just cannot deny. You just cannot deny it because it's so obviously true and so forth. Well, the problem with Descartes' understanding of knowledge as being 100% certainty and so forth leads people to the idea that if you don't know something with 100% certainty, then the alternative is utter skepticism. You just can't know anything. And what I think we as Christians need to be alert to is just saying, I reject those two alternatives, that either you know something with 100% certainty or you can't know anything at all. And so I would say that there are degrees of knowledge that we can have. For example, I know with great confidence that adultery is wrong. I know with great confidence that 2 plus 2 equals 4. I know with less confidence that the universe is expanding, that subatomic particles exist. But you know, there's still a very good reason for taking those claims seriously, although we will hold to certain beliefs more firmly than others because they're just so much more accessible to us, much better, much more reliable in their truth status than others. And so we are going to be much more confident in what we believe. And so there are degrees of knowledge that we need to keep that in mind. Because if we simply assume that if something is 100% certain, that only qualifies for knowledge, then basically we won't be able to distinguish between good alternatives or good hypotheses and very silly ones. Because we'll just have to say, oh, they're all basically on the same level. And, of course, that is deeply problematic. So I think those are a couple of things to keep in mind when we're dealing with people on that skeptical front. And when it comes to the whole issue of pragmatism, when people say, well, that's just what works for you. Christianity is true because that works for you. Of course, there are problems with that. What do you mean by works? When you're saying something works for you, well, we can talk about people like Hitler or Stalin, certain things working for them. Hitler's anti-Judaism, quote, worked for him, at least for a time. But do we want to say that he was right in what he was affirming? Of course not. And I think it's helpful to keep in mind that, what do you do with a conflict problem when you have two viewpoints that butt heads with one another? When one person's version of works is completely opposed to another person's version. So Hitler's version of what works is opposed to a Jewish person's version of what works. And so we're going to need to come to some sort of an understanding that you can't just leave things at some sort of an impasse where you don't make judgments about truth, about things the way that they are. There are certain things that are true, even if they don't work for us. For example, today's temperature at the North Pole, that may not do something for us, but you know, the temperature is what it is. And on the other hand, there may be certain things that work for us that may be completely false. For example, if the naturalist is correct, the idea that nature is all that there is no God, there are no miracles and so forth. If nature is all that there is, and we simply are believing things that help us to survive and reproduce, well, we might believe, for example, that human beings are valuable, that human beings have moral obligations, but that may be completely false. It might help us to survive, but it might be completely false. And so the question is, if we recognize that there are certain things that that don't match up with reality, what are we going to do with them? Are we going to simply go along living according to what does not match up with reality, or are we going to come to terms with, well, I'm living a life that is basically following a lie? And so then the question comes, well, what can we do with, when Jesus breaks into the scene, the Apostle Paul says, if Christ hasn't been raised from the dead, then let's just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we're going to die. We're still in our sins. There is no forgiveness. And so the Apostle Paul says there's a lot more to it than simply, well, that just works for you. Paul says, no, if Christ hasn't been raised from the dead, it doesn't matter how happy, the quote, the Christian faith makes us. If Christ hasn't been raised, then it's false.
And I think that that example illustrates the fact that, in a sense, the pragmatist is onto something in that truth should work for a person. It should make a, in terms, especially if we're talking about, universal absolute truth about the ultimate realities like God, then truth should work. But work really in this context means not just work for the moment, get us by in the short term, but does it really accomplish the long term goals of what life is all about? I mean, for example, if you've got a guy walking down the street and he says, I believe I'm headed toward the post office, but actually he's walking the opposite direction, well, his sense of purpose that he's going to the post office may be working for him in the sense that it is enabling him to keep going because he thinks he's going to the post office, but in fact he's not. And right. So in that broader sense, it's not working for him at all.
Exactly.
And when we talk about, I think Christians can say, look, we believe Christianity works too, but what it really does is it gets you to an eternal relationship with the creator of the universe. And that isn't going to happen through a religion that does not have a means of atonement for sin, that does not have salvation provided to those who are lost and estranged from God. And that's what Jesus Christ does. Jesus Christ brings us back into a relationship with God. He reconciles us to God. And no other religion can offer that. No human-made, man-made religion can do that. So, in other words, Christians, I think, can steal the pragmatist's thunder a little bit. Say, you know what? I want a religion that works, too. I want a belief system that works. But I want it that's going to work for eternity, not just for the moment.
Right. And I think it's good in that case to, you're absolutely right. The pragmatist does have a certain point or something to, in a sense, an insight to remind the Christian that working is important, that it is. But the question is, does working simply, if something works, does that make it right? Well, again, a lot depends upon what the actual goals are, and again, I don't want to get too far afield here, but you're right in pointing out that there needs to be that that understanding that the Christian faith works precisely because it's true.
Well, Paul, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today, and I'm sure that people who are listening will become much better informed on this subject of relativism. If I can even say the word, after an hour of talking about it. But folks, if you are interested in this subject beyond what you've heard here, if this has whetted your appetite, we have some resources on our website, www.fortruth.net, on the, various subjects relating to the question of relativism, including a couple of articles that Paul Copan has written for us. Also, I would encourage you to take a look at his books that deal with these kinds of issues. Again, one of them is called True for You, But Not True for Me, but Not for Me. Another one's called That's Just Your Interpretation. We could have spent some considerable time talking about that. A lot of people have the idea of relativism and biblical interpretation. that the Bible means whatever you think it means. And so that's a very important subject in and of itself. And Paul has written an entire book called That's Just Your Interpretation, which focuses a great deal on that particular claim. And then he's also written a book called How Do You Know You're Not Wrong? And that's another question that non-Christians often will throw out at the Christian. Sometimes I think they throw these things out just to see what will stick, you know, see what will stick. And sometimes they think they stick when they don't. But I would encourage people to take a look at any of those books or all of those books. Again, our guest today has been Paul Copan. That's C-O-P-A-N, if you want to look his name up. The books that he's written. He's also written a book with William Lane Craig on creation out of nothing, which I highly recommend on that particular subject. Paul, thanks a lot for being with us.
Very good to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening to 4truth.net.